for this morning is appeal number 092764. I think it's pronounced Iguanuam versus Cook County Sheriff's Department. Ms. Kurtz.
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Dana L. Kurtz, appearing for the appellant Ayari Egoan, and we're requesting that the court reverse the district court's grant of summary judgment in this case and remand the case for trial for a decision by a finder of fact. I have three essential points today. The first point is the defendants essentially claim that their conduct is insulated by the prosecution of the state's attorney's office, which is directly contradicted by Supreme Court case Malley v. Briggs, Hartman v. Moore. In Malley v. Briggs and in the Seventh Circuit cases such as Jones v. City of Chicago, 1988, Seventh Circuit case, Sornberger v. City of Knoxville, also Seventh Circuit case, 2006, and numerous other cases where this court and the Supreme Court has held that a prosecutor does not immune an individual defendant's liability where either they provided false information to the state's attorney's office, misinformation, they failed to provide information, and in this case, there's a plethora of evidence in the record that was not provided to the state's attorney's office. I'd like to start first with the comparison on the race discrimination claim with respect to Officer Paul Usiak and Officer Ayari Egoan. In the record, in the district court at page 13 of the order indicates that there was no evidence in the record that Paul Usiak had had sexual relations with a detainee while incarcerated. However, in the record, and this is provided in the supplemental appendix to our reply brief, the investigators, in fact, indicate in the report that Usiak, one, was not advised of his Miranda rights when he was called and questioned, and was informed that he was free to leave. Usiak was advised he could refuse to answer any questions. He was informed of the allegations that he had sexual relationship with the detainee, Rock, and of a sexually explicit letter that he wrote to her, quote unquote, while she was incarcerated. This is evidence in the record. The evidence against Officer Paul Usiak was substantial with respect to him having sexual relations with detainee Rock while she was incarcerated.
This is the white officer who was the subject of the investigation, the internal investigation, and the external investigation?
He was the subject. However, the criminal investigation, when he was called in, right after they asked him questions, he was again called in. He admitted that he was in love with her. He admitted that he lied to the investigators, and this is in the supplemental appendix. And the next thing you see in the investigator's report, the sheriff's office, their report is that without corroborating evidence to pursue criminal charges, the investigation regarding Usiak was turned over to internal affairs, not turned over to the state's attorney's office. But yet the sheriff's office first arrested Officer Egoan on August 13, 2003 at 12:2500 hours, then took him into custody, read him his Miranda rights, asked him whether he it indicates in the report that he refused to make a statement. Now, that evidence is disputed. In fact, Egoan says that he denied the allegations. 7 hours later, the sheriff's office, as indicated in the report, forwarded the information for approval by the state's attorney's office for felony charges. So you have all of this evidence that the sheriff's office, they only arrested three African-American officers. They didn't arrest Officer Usiak. They forwarded the information only about the three African-American officers to the state's attorney's office, not Officer Usiak. And in addition to that, they withheld evidence. They withheld tear logs, which showed that there was absolutely no way that Egoan could have had sexual relations, as was alleged, supposedly, by Aurora Cunha.
There were over 20 officers who were investigated in this case, the claim, at least 20. I know you represented Swearingen, and in fact, we're going to have a repeat of the argument we heard back in January. same, essentially the same case. One thing that both your client and Swearengen, who was also your client, were acquitted during court trials. Were those bench trials before the same judge in Cook County?
No, they were bench trials before two different judges. And the third African-American was also a bench trial against with a third separate judge in Cook County. All of the three of them were acquitted. And all three of them in the bench trials, which are in the record, the trial transcripts from all three trials are in the record. Those three judges indicated that the inmates could not be believed, that they were incredible, that there was not enough evidence. And, in fact, in some, it was essentially a directed finding. So not only do you have that evidence, but then you have evidence in the record, which the district court completely disregards, that inmates were threatened to implicate these three officers. They were only shown pictures of African-American officers. They weren't shown pictures of white officers. That, that in fact, the inmates, Aurora Acuna, and in the Swearengen case, Portia Warrington, had initially denied the allegations. They said they didn't have any knowledge of it. And it was only until after they were offered deals, which was years off of their criminal sentences, did they turn and say that, yes, these officers were involved. There was a plethora of evidence.
There were tons of cell phone calls and that sort of thing between at least Swearengen and what was her name, Portia or something. Right?
Correct, Portia Warrington.
I don't think there's anything like that in this case.
There were no calls by Egoan. However, there were calls by USIAC, as indicated in the supplemental report by the sheriff's office, in which they ask him and indicate that, in fact, they had records that he had called her several times. I mean, essentially what we're looking at is what the Supreme Court held in McDonald versus Santa Fe. It's a 1976 Supreme Court case. It's still good law. It's consistent with this court's decisions in numerous other cases, is that you can't be selective about who's going to be prosecuted, which is exactly what the sheriff's office did in this case. They only sent these three officers to the state's attorney's office after they were arrested. That is undisputed. If you look at the timeline in the supplemental report, that is undisputed. It'd be a different story if they had submitted USIAC also, if they'd submitted all 23 officers to the state's attorney's office to see whether or not felony criminal charges could be initiated based on all the evidence that they had. They did not do that.
How many African-American officers were in the group that were not referred for prosecution?
I don't have the exact number. I think it's about 10 to 15.
Quite a few.
Yeah, quite a few. However, that's the other issue with respect to, if you look at Katie Harrison's statements. Katie Harrison was the superintendent at the time, and this relates directly to his gender discrimination equal protection claim. In this case, it's our contention that there's direct evidence. Even if it's not direct evidence, it's circumstantial evidence. You have direct statements from her, that you have clear evidence that, and the defendant does not dispute that in this case, that he complained about her sexual harassment starting in September of 2002. And then he makes a written complaint. After he makes a written complaint, she says that she's going to make his life hell, and that she would, and I won't use the explicitive that she used, but mess up his life. She did that. She did that in this case by submitting to Internal Affairs a false complaint. Aurora Acuna never complained about Yari Egoan. You have her testimony in her deposition, in which inconsistent testimony. She changed her testimony. Initially, in her first deposition, she said that Nicole Burns had complained about Swearengen, Egoan, and Anthony. Then in her second deposition, she said she never got any complaints about Swearengen, Egoan, and Anthony. And in fact, it was at that point that we had finally received Nicole Burns' complaint and her interview of Nicole Burns, which indicates complaints about Buchanan and McBride, who were not arrested, who were not submitted to the state's attorney's office for prosecution. So you have evidence, enough evidence to get to a jury. This is a case for the jury to decide. There are disputed issues of fact. Allow a fact finder to make a determination as to whether or not Katie Harrison's actions that initiated this whole mess against him was for racial reasons, the department's failure to prosecute, failure to send USIAC, was for reasons based upon the fact that he wouldn't go out with her, in which she specifically told him that...
If I could just clarify the conceptualization of these claims. I understood these claims to relate to your client's termination rather than his prosecution, because the defendants in this case are his employers, his municipal employers.
Right, and that's
so
what...
We can't turn this into a sort of mini-trial on the propriety of the prosecution.
And it's both, Your Honor, because in this case is different than your typical malicious prosecution claim, because here it's the employer who has the ability to arrest and to send, because it's the sheriff's office.
Right, but I didn't conceptualize this as a malicious prosecution claim in the first place. I thought it was a race and gender discrimination claim and a First Amendment retaliation claim focusing on his termination.
It is
flowed from the investigation, but
correct.
Most of the focus in the argument and in the briefs in this case and the last one 6 weeks ago was the propriety of the prosecution.
And that's because it's both. It is not only essentially you wouldn't even had the malicious prosecution, the criminal case or the merit board case, had it not been, one, for Katie Harrison, the superintendent, forwarding the false information to Internal Affairs, had it not been for her supervisors, the directors, Baird, Kurtovich, and then ultimately Sheehan, signing off on the report on the investigation and submitting it not only to the state's attorney's office but to the merit board. So you can't even get to the merit board, you can't get to the criminal case unless you look at all the underlying facts. And it's no different than the Supreme Court's decision in McDonald versus Santa Fe, whether it's selective prosecution on a criminal case or selective prosecution in terms of termination charges, that there's not an equal balance here. And he was treated differently. Both, there's evidence in the record, both based on his race as well as based on his gender, based upon Katie Harrison's statements and even Investigator Mosley's statements of who was an investigator in Internal Affairs, is that you must have really pissed her off because she's out to get you during the investigation. And it's enough evidence that this case should be allowed to go to trial. I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sorry.
Mr. Gallagher.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Daniel Gallagher. I represent the defendants, appellees, in this case. On April 9, 2003, a detainee, Nicole Burns, wrote a letter to Katie Harrison, the superintendent of Division 4, which was the women's division at the time in the Cook County Jail, alleging that male officers were having sexual relations with female detainees. In the context of a correctional institution, allegations of sexual abuse by officers against detainees is one of the most egregious and serious allegations of misconduct which can be brought. Superintendent Katie Harrison interviewed Nicole Burns and also another detainee by the name of Stacy Samuels, who confirmed Nicole Burns' allegations and named officers Robert Buchanan and Officer McBride as people who were involved.
And one of the main arguments that your opponents have made here is that Harrison, whose affections were spurned apparently by the plaintiff here, engineered this whole, or helped to engineer the whole episode. And in your brief, you didn't spend much time responding to that.
Well,
that
because
argument, I didn't think.
I think
it may be because you were viewed that as a raising a different claim or something.
I think it does raise a different claim.
Not being relevant to this particular appeal, but could you explain what
sure.
what's your what your argument is on that point.
Sure. He was the subject of discipline. After he had been disciplined, after he had been de-deputized by Katie Harrison for something totally unrelated to this, he then made a claim of sexual harassment against her, which was completely investigated, completely vetted, and it turned out that it was false. It was unfounded, and it was investigated by the IAD. It was something to throw in the way because this individual was repeatedly being disciplined, and not just by Katie Harrison. But it turned out that the reason he was de-deputized on September 1st was for something that he had done when he was in Division 9 when Katie Harrison wasn't there. She just happened to be the bearer of the bad news to tell him that he was being de-deputized at that time. And that was a diversion. But with respect to this, Katie Harrison never related to either the Sheriff's Department, Police Department, or to the State's Attorney's Office that Aganamon was one of the culprits, or that Mr. Anthony, or that Mr. Swernigan was. When she was given her asked in her deposition, was that in your report? She wasn't shown her report. And she said, yeah, I think I know there were names in there. I think those were the names. When she was finally shown her report later on during the deposition, she said, oh, I was mistaken. The only two people that were in my report were McBride and Buchanan. So she didn't have anything to do with it. Once the investigation began, Ms. Harrison turned it over to IAD and Investigator Mosley. Mosley then, recognizing that there were criminal violations implicated, referred it to the Cook County Sheriff's Police Department. And I know we were talking earlier about the Sheriff's Department, but the Sheriff's Office is divided into three separate, independent, distinct departments. There is the Cook County Department of Corrections, which is the largest one. As one of the members of the court pointed out, there's about 10,000 people a day there. There's also about 3,000 employees there every day.
That's the jail division.
That's the jail. And that's what this was. This was the jail division. The Cook County Sheriff's Police Department, which did the investigation in this case, is a separate law enforcement agency. Correctional officers do not have the law enforcement certification that the police department has. The Department of Corrections has its own executive director, its own general orders, and its own IAD. The Sheriff's Police Department has its own chief, has its own general orders, and has its own IAD. And the Court Services Division, which is similar to the U.S. Marshal's Office as far as providing protection in the courts, has another. It's a separate thing. So in this particular instance, when it was turned over to the Cook County Sheriff's Police Department, that's a separate law enforcement agency. And, by the way, it's the only game in town. Who else can the sheriff turn it over to? The Chicago Police Department doesn't have jurisdiction inside the county jail, just as Chicago Police Department doesn't have jurisdiction inside this building. So the only persons to turn it over is to the Sheriff's Police Department. They then notified the state's attorney's office. This was first turned in by Ms. Harrison on April 16, 2003, and by May 1, two state's attorneys in the Felony Review Division, Lauren Freeman and also Sherry LaCrone, had been assigned to this case. They're experienced prosecutors. They then took over the investigation. They conducted the investigation in concert with the Sheriff's Police Department. And counsel is wrong. Everything that was in that police report, that entire report, which is part of the record, was turned over to the state's attorney's office. And the state's attorneys conducted several interviews. They conducted the interviews of Acuna and Warrington. They interviewed those people. The charges were brought by the state's attorney's office. The sheriff has no authority, and this court well knows that, to bring charges. They cannot bring a charge. It has to be approved by the state's attorney's office. In this instance, this fellow was arrested on August 13th or 14th. Within 7 hours, he was charged by the state's attorney's office, and approximately 3 weeks later, he was indicted by a grand jury. But again, we're conflating the two things, the prosecution and the administrative review. The administrative review, USIAC was treated exactly the same, the white officer. There were approximately 12 African-American officers that were in this group of 20. Three of them were indicted. That means 9 were not indicted. But all 3 of those people were recommended for termination. USIAC, whose information was turned over, by the way, to the state's attorney's office, and the state's attorney's office declined not to prosecute, was nevertheless brought up on charges before the merit board, and he resigned. The difference between Agamemnon and USIAC was there was proof that Agamemnon had sexual relations with at least 2 inmates in the county jail. USIAC wound up setting up housekeeping with someone who had been released from the jail. When they brought her in, she said, "No, we never had sex while we were in the jail." All they had were the letters that he had sent her. So I think under those circumstances, it was the state's attorney who decided if they were going to bring in Ms. Rock, she wasn't going to admit that they had had sex in the jail at any event. But nevertheless, the sheriff still felt that was grounds for termination. When he brought the termination claim against them to the merit board, Anthony resigned, Swearingen resigned, and USIAC. All 3 resigned. The only one who didn't resign was Agamemnon. But what he did was he did not participate in the Loudermill hearing. And furthermore, he was given 3 or 4 continuances of his termination hearing. And he had a lawyer. Then the lawyer withdrew. He showed up again after his acquittal. They were going to have the final hearing. And he walked out. He walked out. He didn't participate. He could have raised all of these issues that counsel's talking about, perhaps, certainly in this merit board hearing. And also, even if he didn't participate in the hearing, he had 35 days after they issued their decision to file an appeal. And he never filed an appeal. Instead, he brought this action. The control here for charging was with the state's attorney's office. It was not with the sheriff's department, and that can be evidenced by Detective Shelton, who testified in his deposition. He was one of the investigators. They asked him what he thought about the prosecution, and he said if it had been up to him, he would have brought charges against all 20 of the officers. But obviously, he doesn't have that control, and he's an employee of the sheriff's police department. The state's attorney decided that they only had 3 people that they could prosecute. With respect to USIAC, he was ultimately fired. He was treated the same way as the other individuals. As far as false information at the trial, that Agamemnon wasn't there or something, Gwen Davis testified, who was the record keeper, that he was on the tier that day, and Acuna and Warrington were on the tier, and that it could have happened. There's no indication that anybody from the sheriff's office threatened anybody. As far as Acuna and Warrington being given lesser sentences or probation or whatever it was they got, and I don't know, that's done frequently in criminal cases where witnesses comply. And that, again, the state's attorney makes that decision completely and wholly. It doesn't have anything to us. In the end, the plaintiffs, everything that the defendants did was by the book. When confronted with this sexual misconduct case, they couldn't ignore the complaints of a female detainee claiming sexual contact by correctional officers. The evidence against Agamemnon that he violated General Order 3.8 and 4.1 is overwhelming. And it's not the evidence that was provided by the Sheriff's Department. Not one of these defendants testified against him. Acuna and Warrington testified they had sexual relations, but Gonzalo Acuna, who is Aurora Acuna's brother, testified that, in fact, Mr. Agamemnon came to his house on 2 occasions, and he gave him money for his sister in payment for the sexual relations. That testimony is even more egregious than what was in the Swearingen case, where he made, I think, there were over 100 phone calls made to him. And as far as not being identified, page 61 of Mr. Agamemnon's trial, it sets forth, did you have an opportunity? They're asking Mr. Acuna, Gonzalo, do you have seen anyone in this courtroom today? Who is it? Yeah, the man right there with the glasses on the left side. Ms. Freeman, may the record reflect an in-court identification of the defendant. He identified Mr. Agamemnon in court. The same thing happened at the merit board hearing. And again, the merit board is the decision maker. The sheriff's not the decision maker. He's insulated from that. Once they make their decision, and Mr. Ganemwan didn't either participate in it and didn't appeal it, I don't think it can be put upon the sheriff that he was the one who made the decision. And if there's no further questions, I'll glad to sit down. Thank you very much for your time.
Ms. Kurtz, you have 2 minutes in rebuttal.
May it please the court, just a few points on rebuttal, and I'll deal with my worthy opponent here's last argument first regarding Gonzalo Acuna. In fact, we attached to the reply brief supplemental appendix page 19, in which Gonzalo Acuna was questioned at the criminal trial. Question, you did not at a particular time when he was questioned by sheriff's police and in fact shown pictures, you did not at that particular time identify our client as the person who brought you money. Isn't that correct? Says, no, I didn't. So he did not identify Egoan, and the first time he identified Officer Egoan as supposedly the person that brought him the money was at the criminal trial when he was sitting at the defense, at the criminal defendant's table. So, and with respect to the argument that UCAC was treated the same, he wasn't treated the same. There's no evidence in the record that inmates were threatened to implicate UCAC. There's no evidence in the record that inmate Cindy Rock was offered a deal to implicate UCAC. And in fact, I believe it was Ms. Freeman, State's Attorney Freeman, and I don't have the record site, I can supplement or that. In fact, she testified she didn't know who Paul UCAC was. She didn't know who he was. That is substantial evidence that there are disputed issues of fact in this case that entitle Egoan to a trial on the merits of his claims. There's evidence that they weren't separate. In fact, Kaufman, which is an admission against a party opponent, told Officer Egoan that he would drop the criminal charges if he resigned. That it was the sheriff's office, his employer, that not only brought the criminal charges, but the sheriff himself, based on these false allegations, in which inmates were threatened, in which inmates were offered deals, to not only criminally prosecute him, but to fire him. The allegation, the issue, and I see my time has expired. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.